like to introduce the panel. So the first person of this evening is Jude Adams. Jude Adams has previously been a lecturer at the University of South Australia in Art, Architecture and Design. And she's taught since, I think, 1984. And she's taught undergrad a huge range of subjects, but particularly gender and art has been a topic of interest. I think also just to mention how I ended up working with Jude, we had an intersection and looked particularly at cross-generational discussions around feminism. So I think there's obviously some huge distance and respect between different experiences and time of feminism in the 70s now. So like, I want to know, we had an exhibition that I curated called Beyonce is a Feminist, which got a lot of conversations going. That's how Jude and I recently reconnected, and we've worked together to form a group called FRAN, the Feminist Revival Art Network, which is a growing group in Adelaide. So I think there's a real timeless at the moment in terms of group performance, looking at archiving, looking at the past and now. So Jude is someone who brings a huge resource of knowledge and experience, so it'd be great to have Jude up here now.
I'm going to start with two anecdotes, which link two different periods, the 1970s and today, the 21st century. And just before I do, I want to say that I'm talking about feminist art, and that is shorthand for any art that is in some ways informed by feminist ideals or concepts or something. In the same way when I talk about feminist artists, they're not necessarily card-carrying feminists, but those who are some sister travellers, if you like. And also when I refer to second wave feminism, I'm referring to the period of May of the 1970s, starting in the late 1960s, beginning with the 1980s. So that's the area of second wave feminism, although it waves as a concept is a little problematic. All that shorthand. Anyway, the two anecdotes I'm saying now. One is, some of you might have seen it, this is Marina Abramovich's in residence that was in Sydney at Pier 23, Walsh Bay, over a period of about 12 days, and 12 artists were included in her in residence performance to live on site and to work with visitors, etc. And what she did was teach these 12 artists what was called the Abramovich Method. Okay, and there was an interview or a review in the monthly magazine about the whole process. And it was interesting to read because the reviewer did have a conversation with four of the women who were involved in the artists. And their response is quite suggestive of their scepticism. They described the meetings as fluffy and the rules arbitrary. For instance, you had to keep the curtains open at all times. And one of them did the bell and closed the curtains and put a note up that says, taking a nap. Another rule or requirement was for the 12 artists to eliminate all body toxins before sunrise. One of the artists were sort of not clear about what they had to do initially, but they did have to do a presentation. So one of the women suggested that the performance idea would be to massage the artist to get the ideas out and then call the performance shit before sunrise. Another artist decided that her performance presentation was going to be a send-up on artist's personality. So the gist of the, and I'm not being critical of anything else for as well. But the gist of the comments was that the artist's response to Abramovich's method was to take reading. Okay, so the next anecdote refers to an episode back in the 70s, Judy Chicago's dinner party. Most of you probably know this work, made between 1974 and 1979 in America. It's an installation work of 39 plates and 99 signatures of women honouring women in history, and it's involved 400 apparently volunteers working in ceramics, needlework, researchers, etc. to produce the work. Now, back in 1978, I think it was, two of the volunteers were from Australia, Frances Phoenix, who might be today, I don't know, and Marina Mann, who had developed a keen interest in domestic needlework and were eager to join Chicago's project. The reality, however, they found was quite different. The organisation of the project was described as the benevolent hierarchy, but in fact, Frances and Marina found that the approach from Chicago was authoritarian and dictatorial rather than benevolent. So our two feminist artists decided to engage in a little subversion. And when they were sitting there, you know, quietly working on the runners, the tables as they were meant to do, but Marina and Frances decided to make a little sewing piece of their own which says no goddesses, no mistresses, referring to the organisation of the dinner party. And they secretly made this little doily, if you like, and put it into one of the runners on the table. They worked all out. Never mind, they did it. Now, so what that, I think, does, those two anecdotes, 40 years apart, make it clear, I think, that Australian women artists, certainly feminists, don't take too kindly to authoritarianism, no matter where it comes from. Celebrity artists, or taking oneself too seriously, don't need to take work, of course, seriously. So this sort of subversive, eye-rolling humour, I think, might well be a characteristic of Australian feminist artists, to prefer to work collaboratively rather than in submission to the star artists. Can we go? I've just put this in. This is Maria Kosick's work that was in the pop show in New South Wales Gallery, I think, a year ago. And it's just reminds me of Barbara Kruger's work, which says we don't need another hero. So again, it's a little bit of that subversive feminism. Now, evidence suggests that today there is a plethora of women-based groups or women coming together to produce exhibitions and projects. To name just a few, and I think the other people on the panel might talk about them, there's Brown Council, Twilight Girls, Janice the Kingpins, etc. Collaboration was central to second-wave feminism. The formation of the women's art movements beginning in 1974 in Sydney, 1975 in Adelaide, or 76 in Adelaide, I think. Journals or magazines such as Lit Magazine and women's exhibitions were collaborative ventures, many of course were unfunded. And working collaboratively was often a struggle that was always well documented in these sort of publications. The Adelaide Women's Show here, that was called Women's Show 1977, was at the EA for various satellite events, was one of the largest all-inclusive collaborative projects of the time. When I went online, you couldn't find anything about it, so that's really interesting. It was organised by a collective of 50 women, over 150 works were displayed. Well over 70 women artists were included. People you've probably heard of, like Anne Newmarch, Mona Dodd, Ollie Bishop, Anne Marshall, Martin, Pam Harris, Sloane Fuller, etc. There were student exhibition women's films, theatre, experimental music. It was enormous, absolutely mammoth event. All done, I think, on virtually no money. We've gone too fast. Can we go back? Oh no, okay, no, take the next one. It's mine instead. Okay. This was one of the registries just before my advertisement for Women's Art Registry poster. Now, this was a work that was in the Women's Show, and it's by Frances Phoenix, and it's called Mary's Blood Never Failed Me. And I've included it because it encapsulates the very radical nature of feminist art there and how it actually changed the landscape of art. That period. The subject matters taboo, or would have been taboo, menstruation. But with the title, it makes it, you know, even more transgressive as it has a religious reference. The media is tampons, Kotex pads, fabric, and free, all very much associated with despised femininity. And it's sewn together with a sort of lacework trim, so it references craft-based, small, decorative works. In other words, a decade earlier, this work would have ever been exhibited. And so it produces a whole, it opens up a whole space for quite different works from the 70s onwards. In other words, some of you may make today. So the 70s introduced women's experience, feminine aesthetics into the world of art, which beforehand had been completely marginalised. Women's shows on a much grander scale made a comeback in the 24th century. There's WAC, Art and Feminist Revolution in New York in 2007, which I think only the pretty artist from different countries, only one from Australia, though, and in March. Global Feminisms in New York, 2007. Elves at Pompidou, which was turning over Pompidou Centre to women artists from 2009 to 2011. And Contemporary Australia Women at Government Gallery of Modern Art in Queensland, which again had, you know, a lot of 40 artists. And look again in Perth, in the Girls' Theatre. So major exhibitions of large collections of women exhibited. WAC, Art and the Feminist Revolution, has been particularly influential in promoting the re-evaluation of second-wave feminist art, with critics such as Holly Cotter saying, or declaring, that feminist art was the formative art of the last four decades. It reshaped the landscape of contemporary art. Arthur Danto, a well-known critic even back in the 80s, was saying the most innovative works coming from women. WAC, along with Abramovich's 70s pieces in 2005, has been instrumental in bringing pioneering feminist performances such as Carolyn Schumann's Interior Scroll, Yoko Ono's Cut Piece, Martha Wilson's Semiotics of the Kitchen. You don't need novels or this book. Bringing them to the fore and prompting the emergence of re-performance by a generation of younger artists. That one is by Valley Export, and it's based on her initial, well, it's not by her, but it's based on a performance she did in 1969, I think, called Action Pants, Genital Panic. Again, you can look it up online, and that's re-performed by Melanie Roniger, 2012, with a slight difference that all the hair's been dyed with the colours. Okay, so there's this real interest in taking these early feminist works and re-performing them. It's a way of paying homage to feminist works, but often humour, like this, is added a certain irony or parody. I think today's feminist artists realise that humour can be a disarming strategy. It's more productive often than an attack. Re-performance also takes on an archival approach. Re-performance acknowledges past feminist works, rescues them from historical and curatorial oblivions, so they are brought into the present. Re-performance also establishes and maintains feminist lineage. So work of the 70s or neglected work can be part of canon formation. And most particularly, unlike the classic modernist avant-garde, which is seen in Freudian terms as the son symbolically killing the father, you know, rejecting the art that goes before, contemporary feminist art, by employing reenactment, acknowledge their art mothers, thus presenting an alternative model or approach to understanding innovation and change. In other words, an alternative avant-garde strategy, which builds on work from the past rather than having to reject it. Revisiting second-wave feminist art isn't limited solely to performance, but also takes in broader aspects of 70s feminism. This is an illustration from Brown Council for women based in Sydney, collective that worked together, and it was called Mass. It's from Mass Action, 137 cakes in 90 hours. It was a durational performance. Went for 24 hours. It was cooking every cake in the CWA cookbook. So it was a tribute to women's domestic skills, formerly four-day bake-off, and references in this picture, which I think was advertised in the event, references the activist or the agitprop nature of 70s feminism. But, you know, just a little bit of irony there, you know, the demonstrations, the wearing of the overalls, the ring, you know. If we flip out to the next one, which is me, and yes, way back then, we did wear overalls. An early Anne Marsh performance, Discourse, which was performed here at Adelaide WAN, and was an artist here, although she's well known as a writer now, was called Discourse, and it drew on the strategy of consciousness raising, feminist consciousness raising at the time. And a photo, which is this one, you can vaguely see it on the poster, that was taken of that performance back in 1979, was referenced by Alex Martin's Rowe in her relational-based performance called The Practice of Doing in 1913 work. Anyway, Martin's Rowe was going to use the image in her catalogue, but the organisations of the whole exhibition, which was called New 13, took the image of Anne Marsh's Discourse and used that in the poster to advertise it. Okay, Brown Council have also just recently presented a performative lecture based on the impact of the critic Lucy Rippard's visit to Australia in 1975, where she visited women's groups, as well as giving a lecture on perceptuality, and visited women's groups in each city. Now, this performative approach, not only just re-performing performances, but re-enacting, if you like, is a sort of a performative radical approach to documenting history, bringing the past into the present and suggesting that feminists are might be more likely to work in a series of ways. And I think just like humour might be a particularly Australian quality in some of these performances. Performative or re-performative history may also be a characteristic that might be specific to Australian feminist art today. Okay, I'll briefly refer to the similarities between 70s feminism and contemporary feminist art. They are humour, large or women's group shows, collaboration, performance and re-performance. There are differences, of course. Contemporary feminism's engagement with celebrity and social media and the sort of lifestyle of feminism, you know, beauty vegan feminism or lean out feminism, hanging out all feminism. These are some of the issues contemporary feminists are dealing with. 70s feminism, you could say, is blurring the boundary between art and life. Contemporary feminism, perhaps, is blurring the boundary between art and popular culture. But another shared element between second wave feminism in the 70s and now is the focus on issues of equality. Today's call out on sexism, discrimination and glass ceiling echo the equal opportunity campaigns of the 70s. And they also raise the question, did postmodernism steer us away from equality issues? We've got one of these up here. Of course, there's been significant improvements for the conditions of women artists and their representation since the 70s. One I just came across was in 1973 to 1975, only one, mind you, the funding obviously had just started, but only 1% of visual arts board funding, as it was called then, went to women artists, although 50% There were 50% women applications.
1%.
So definitely improved from that time. The Art Gallery of New South Wales only included 9 women in their collection in 1975. And commercial survey of commercial galleries in New South Wales at the time said 22% of women exhibited in commercial galleries, 22% of artists in commercial galleries were women. In some cases, there might have been a lot of improvement on that last figure. Now slide 12 deals with that sort of imbalance that has been all the time. The majority of students are women, but the majority of artists are men, and that's a statistic from the 1970s and earlier. So statistics on the representation of women in journals, exhibitions, collections and events reveal that there is still a way to go before we achieve parity between men and women artists. And this last one is one, and I haven't got the recent, this is the 2012 biennial that was here, and that proportion is often quite familiar. You know that the majority of artists are men, small amount, a third are women. And in fact, I looked at the Venice Biennale this year, and again, it's a 2-to-1 ratio. Two-thirds men and one-third women, and that seems to be sort of standard for a lot of exhibitions and collections in the last 30 years or so. Okay, that's it.
So I'd love to introduce Kate Power next. Kate Power is a sculpture and installation artist based here in Adelaide. Her practice embraces video, craft, textile, sculpture and installation to investigate coexistence and enforce constructions that can complicate how we relate to each other. She graduated first class from South Australian School of Art in 2014, and she's been awarded the Constance Gordon Johnson Sculpture and Installation Prize. She's exhibited all over the place, Felt Space, Cave Mountain, RE in West Australia, Light Square Gallery, Fontenelle, Tooth and Nail, Format, and this goes on. And she's also co-director of Felt Space and a co-founding member of AXA Studio, so really great to have you.
I thought I'd start by talking about my personal feminist roots and how they evolved in my art practice, and then feminism in some of my artist practice and how they shaped mine. I think women come to feminism at all different times and in different ways. Personally, I was born into a feminist household and I had a very active and vocal feminist mother. And even though it's always been a big part of my life, it took me a while to acknowledge it, take ownership of it, and then find my shape for it and what I wanted to do with that. Like most teenagers, I spent quite a bit of time feeling uncomfortable with my body and concerned about my actions, I guess. And even though this is something that I think all teenagers experience, girls are aware from a really young age that there is sort of some level of public control, opinion, or entitlement about what she should do with her body. And one of my first experiences of being aware of this was I was in a schoolyard and saw a girl with some friends. And a boy came up to me and singled me out and he said, I just want you to know that boys really don't like it when girls put their hair up in ponytails and probably stop doing it. he was standing there with all of his friends and they were sort of circled around him and had this like shared understanding about what my ponytail meant. And you know, it was completely out of my control and someone aware of what exactly that thing was problematic. And even though I knew this was was really stupid. I couldn't help but feel mistaken and out of control, and actually considered his advice on numerous occasions. So when I became, sturdier in my teen self and more self-assured, I would pull everyone up on every hint of sexism in the session. I felt a really strong discomfort with the ways women are silenced in all areas of public life. I found that often keeping quiet about my discomfort about sexist behaviour was still discomforting myself, but that I was often making other people feel uncomfortable by criticising their behaviour. Overall, I spent a lot of time warring internally with myself or externally with other people, and I carried this discomfort, tenseness and anxiety around my body. When I was in second year art school, I took an installation class, installation art class. And in the first class, the lecturer gave a very passionate and somewhat inspiring introduction to the world of installation art. But during the 60-minute presentation, the only female artists mentioned were Ida Hess and Rebecca Horn. And I was really pissed off about this and wrote an email. But even though I was pissed off about this, the two artists that he did mention I really clutched onto for inspiration and direction. My initial approach to feminism in an art context was thinking about ways to talk about female sexual desire, but valued it as a personal, complex, and important thing that was to be valued in its own right. I was drawn to work that connected a woman to herself and others in ways that was both tender and described the complexity of relating. So Rebecca Horn's Cornucopia Seance with Two Breasts, which is that work there, was especially important to me. It's a wearable sculpture that connects a woman's mouth to her breasts. And when I was writing that down the other day, I accidentally wrote friends and her kiss her breasts. Given things I was thinking about at the time, there was something so perfect about connecting a system between a woman's body and herself that didn't concern others. I imagined it as a moment of care, peace, and interconnectivity. Around the same time I was competing with Rebecca Horn, I started volunteering for Vital Statistics Theatre Company, or Adelaide. The first show that I worked on was by Brown Council, and it was called A Comedy, and it was in 2011. So the work is a 4-hour performance that you can enter in at the beginning of any hour and you can stay for as long as you like. So you can stay for the whole 4 hours, or you can just stay 1 hour. And the performance is inviting the audience to choose a style of comedy. And then the performers will act that out. And the five categories that were to choose from were slapstick, stand-up, dancing monkey, magic trick, and cream pie. And then the audience was invited to display their level of satisfaction with the comedy by throwing tomatoes at the performers. So the show was ultimately about the dark side of comedy, exposing the uncruelties and questioning how far you can take a joke, and also about how jokes often disguise us for other things. This show made a massive impression on me. I started thinking about the potency of humour, but also other social devices that enable people to behave badly and reinforce certain social norms without seeming to be doing anything wrong. And then when I was at Hypocrisy last year, which is another Vital Statistics event, there was an artist there called Lisa Shelton who was presenting her project titled Mapping, a subtitle, Tracing a Shared History of Media Art, Live Art and Performance, Its Key Artists, Practices and Writing Within an Australian Context. And project is about documenting people's experiences of new media and live art. So Lisa sits with participants, she asks questions about their experiences and significant encounters, and then she writes them down on official looking archiving cards, and then she stamps it, seals it, and then she puts it in a steel box, and then those experiences get archived for everybody else's. The project is about memory, visual art, and how new media art affects us visually, and then how we carry these memories around us, and how we work, how we carry the effects of these work around our bodies. Marking the core values of art practice, and exchanging ideas between one person and another. By doing this, she then turns the lasting effect of an experience into a tangible object. When I met Victor's at Hypocrisy, I matched my experience of seeing the Brown Council show. And this process of recognition of the significance of that show, and then mapping that and turning that into a tangible thing, was a really nice way to honour the quiet ways that communities between women are built. And it was also really lovely that Vitals had brought me to these two shows, another community that creates strength and support to women in the arts. When I started Honours, I began to feel uncomfortable with mentioning feminism all the time. It started to feel boring, and like people getting sick of hearing about it. It seemed like a lot of people around me kind of felt quietly like it was unimportant, that maybe less intellectual than other training courts. And I started to feel like feminists cringed, and I felt like people were glazing over every time I entered it. And I remember during this time I was at the pub with an old friend, and telling her that even though what I was ultimately talking about in my art practice was feminist ideas, it was probably best I used different language to talk about it. So that I wouldn't be in a pigeonhole, or that more people could relate to me. And I remember her being really impressed with that. She was like, if that's what your work is about, then why wouldn't you just say that? And I think even though my ideas were encouraged at that point, it's still hard for young women to feel like they're accepting and their personal experiences about the things to talk about and to work about. I started thinking about my work in wider social and political spheres, and I realised that it wasn't just female sexuality as a point of difference that I was interested in, but it was that point of difference that you have from everything that is not yourself. I recently read a book by Chris Krauss called Aims and Anorexia, where she asks, why should women settle for talking about just femaleness when men are constantly transcending their gender? And I've kind of thought about that and thought that even though I can see how labeling all women's practice as feminist could be seen as seductive, I think that making work at a time when women's practices are still marginalised means that, in a way, until there is equality in representation, there is some level of feminism in all women's self-practice. And I think for myself that my gender has shaped the experiences that are most memorable to me when I come up with my work. And in a way, my experiences have been so marked by my gender that being a woman is the best thing that I know. And I feel passionate about this in all inequality, and that making the work I do from a feminist perspective with the ability to connect people on an instinctual level about the ways of how it feels to relate through difference but also through similar experience. So through my work I consider the social constructions that complicate the way people relate to one another. I think about identity and how similarities and differences between people influence interactions. I have a desire to get really connected to people, sometimes so much that I actually imagine being inside other people. But actually, I find connecting with people quite difficult. So I think about how impenetrable other people seem, and how through the curtain of norms this may look. There is often humour in navigating socially acceptable behaviour, and by emphasising it in my work, I think about how humour can be a tool to overcome social obstacles, also how it can be used to jokingly remind someone of their place. So these ideas are a sort of framework for thinking about feelings like loneliness, dysfunction, uncertainty, and suppressed desire. I try to find how it shapes the subtle and seemingly insignificant moments and interactions that can sometimes be more telling than verbal language alone. Artist and writer Randy Delia talks about unimportant things as proof of something so unspecific that it's lively. Moments where I felt inhibited, embarrassed, awkward, or even aroused in interactions drive me to make work that describe things that go unnoticed. And I think this is an attempt to communicate both my experience of how others affect me and also how subtle moments in interactions can reinforce social categories or subvert them. When noticed, unspoken, subtle shifts in energy between people can decipher a positive connection or expose the subtle reinforcement of dominance. Underlying societal instructions that work to subtly contain people into positions of passivity make a framework for me to push against in my work. French philosopher and novelist Alain Cézanne writes about the anxiety surrounding these structures in the book of Promethea, when she says, "I would so much like to be a woman without hearing her thought." When I'm thinking about public life, I often come down to comparing dramatising oneself to feel comfortable and projecting a sort of aggrandised or heroic performance, or a squashed vulnerable demeanour that is the opposite. If I find the shape of things that might seem pathetic, like embarrassment, uncertainty, and loneliness, I see it as a kind of heroic act in itself. Sometimes I play on traditionally heroic qualities, but more often I think about things that are typically seen as unheroic or negative. And by drawing to those, I try and make the idea that they're the ones that move forward, thinking about how can they be co-creative and create change in the world. And by letting my sculptures be righteous about qualities that they should be avoided, I feel like I'm making a small social stand. I imagine not wishing problems to go away, but rather letting the problems make their own shapes. And I guess by letting the problems make their own shapes, this is my way to acknowledge them or to see what they are instead of being made tangible. And I think that because feeling uncertain is much more relatable than knowing exactly what you're doing, I want to celebrate things like vulnerability, things that we usually be avoided, and suggest that this is what can make change in productivity. So I've been a co-director at Felt Space for about a year and a half, which is a massive privilege. I get to run a gallery showing emerging artists with six other brilliant women. But I also get to see what other emerging artists are interested in and how they're expressing those ideas. And just in the small time that I've been at Felt, I've seen proposals from young women who are concerned with feminism and using their art as a way to communicate what I've seen as what is often their experience of operating in the world in their body, and doing making work about this through embodying this reality. And there also seems to be a focus on challenging the strength and heroicism of masculinity by having it perform at the limits of struggle. I think each new group of us reinvents feminism to serve their own needs. And I feel like my generation is often concerned with the internal, personal, and physical, and how control and surveillance are manifested in the body. So to conclude, even though I'm aware that using the word feminism to describe my practice and the practice of others can be seen as simplifying work, I think there are so many categories in art that do that, and that feminism is just another ism or art category, and one that I'm proud to identify with.
So great, thank you, that was excellent. I'd love to introduce our next speaker, Sasha Lovich, who is an artist, writer and lecturer working prominently in the fields of sculpture, installation and video art. She's an avid collector of strange things, found footage, sounds and stories.
Being on these panels gives me the opportunity to, I suppose, provide feminist reading of it and to pick up on some themes which, while they may not be the sort of front and centre concerns of my work, they are certainly part of their work, I think. And so, to sort of reflect in that way on a practice that sort of wouldn't necessarily see feminism as kind of key or that said, I am a feminist, I'm pretty proud to say that. And for me, what that means is wearing my content about gender equality representation on my sleeve. But I recognise also that to say, to even provoke that word feminism is a very kind of complex thing, because it takes in so many other voices, so many other waves or streams of ideas, so many different approaches and tactics, and there's no way that we can discuss all that, agree with all of that, or represent all of that. So it is, it's a grand generalisation, that term, I think. But to say that I'm a feminist is to say that I openly acknowledge that these concerns, the concerns of female representation, are still very important today. We live in a time where it needs to be white, male, heterosexual is still essential economically, legally, and socially. And I'm not male, heterosexual, so my questioning of dominant norms is part of my gay experience, part of our move through the world. I'm an artist, and like I said, I wouldn't characterise feminism as a key explosive in my thinking, but my practice is part of the way that I reflect on and make sense of my world. Zia Coen puts it, art is a tool with which to explore the world. And it's inescapable that my social position be part of this equation. Interestingly, Ergo later modifies her statements to art is a tool of survival, as she explores it as a tool for social change. And I too am interested in art's potential to prompt people to consider their relations to one another and to places. So I'm going to use this opportunity to briefly speak about three more works, and hopefully this is the start of some conversations. We won't speak for quite as long, but I look forward to hearing your questions. Well, I did sort of just say that feminism may not be the discourse of my work. I'm going to start with a work that where it is sort of a central concern, and I think it's the only work that I've made where I've really kind of gone into it, thinking about my sense and my relationship with feminism. It's a work called Untitled Conversation Work, made in 2013. And in the gallery space, the work was shown as a single channel digital video without sound. It's a split screen work, showing my mother on the left side of the screen and me on the right. The work is a visual conversation of reaction shots. In the grammar of film and television, reaction shots are those momentary things that you get when they flip from the person talking, the person reading the content, to the person listening. However, my video is made up completely of reaction shots. It lingers on the person listening, thinking, making sense, watching them translate the other person's conversation. But in the video, our faces show amusement, doubt and confusion as the conversation unfolds. Watching the video, you may pick up that this is a mother-daughter conversation. The age of it perhaps gives away maybe a little bit similar. Or you might pick up on the very familiar love and friction of a familial relationship. In order to make this video, I invited my mother into the studio to have a conversation about feminism. My mother is very involved in second wave feminism as an academic and as an activist. So like her grew up in a strongly feminist household. As well, she undertook research which looked at fathers as primary caregivers of kids and children and mothers as breadwinners. And while she took her PhD along those lines, my dad stayed home and looked after the kids. So like many women of my generation, I have a complex relationship with second wave feminism. I appreciate the amazing work I've taken, but like I said, it's a complex bundle of things and I don't agree with it all. Or I've had some hesitation around some of the tactics and effects. But that said, it's a very important part of my relationship to feminism, thinking through this relationship to second wave feminism. And so I found it's very hard for me to separate my experience of second wave feminism from the experience of growing up with my mother. And I don't give you the sound of our conversation in the video, it's too personal. I give you instead the edges of the reaction shots, the reactions that are evoked to one another. Are these spaces that in which I hope you might contemplate your own relationships with your elders and relationships, the relationship that you may have to different ideas within feminism. The second work I want to address is called Series 1, Uncomfortable Silences, and this work was on at a practical memory, and unfortunately it just finished yesterday, so you can't go along and see it or listen to it anymore. the work takes the form of white vinyl records with record covers placed on a simple table with armchair and a player. It's a sound installation that follows my movement through the city. It follows my own discomforts in public spaces and is very concerned with my body moving through these places. The recordings go from places that I feel particularly challenged or uncomfortable, a particular underpass which I passed on my way home, to places where I can sort of consider other discomforts of the city. So the Victorians, where George Duncan III becomes a site where I think there's a historical point of discomfort. Whitmore Square, where I sat with homeless men and made a recording of the silence as we sat together, provides another sort of city anxiety around homelessness. So the recordings take you through, perhaps through my physical experience, the city, and bring you into relationship with the sounds of these places. I suggest that viewers put on a record and sit with these places and my discomforts, and through that perhaps consider their relationship to my position within the public, their relation to my position within the city. Exploring my own position and body and experience in public situations leads me to this last work that I want to address. Sleep Work, made in 2014, is currently on show as part of the exhibition that Bridget mentioned at Continental Gallery until tomorrow. Sleep Work is filmed as the light changed from bright mid-afternoon to night during summer near Victoria Square. It was important for me that I was asleep in this position. I was interested to see what the world becomes around me. This kind of led to a couple of important thinking about this work, leads to a couple of areas of interest for me. Firstly, how my hands are playing an art-making process. And I think Jude alluded to the role of perhaps collaboration or decentering, which you might relate back to a sort of feminist ethos. For me, this thinking about how my practice sits in relation to how other agencies or other people, things and places might sort of take part in the making process. It is very much part of how I make work. So in this one, I was sort of very deliberately taking myself out of the equation. I was unconscious while the work was being made. I watched the world come around me. And in that way, I suppose I'm exploring this kind of all questioning a position that might suggest artist as sort of dominant central maker, or even human as sort of central in the making process. So I'm shifting that back a little bit. So in that way, I see this work as kind of responding to feminist consent. Like the previous work, it also considers a body in a place, a body in a city, and what happens as that relationship is revealed. The video is 3 hours long. And it's run on separate screens that sit opposite each other. Time shifted by about an hour and a half. And so you can walk in and see the me sleeping during the day or the evening. And then later, as the lights changed into the night, I sleep through the change of light from day to evening. And that change, in that temporal change, that experience changes a lot for other people to see a body in that space, to think about what might have happened or what might happen to a woman in a public place and actual change. For me also, and with my work in general, there is a sense of finding situations and working with them, working with what's found. And working in this way means that I approach my practice with sort of a mode of paying attention, and I think a lot about care within my acts of making. So it's a fairly gentle process, I suppose. I might talk about this in terms of ethics of care, because through my act of making, I sort of respond to, or I think about how I relate to the world, essentially, and this kind of brings me back to why feminism might be a consideration or an undercurrent in the work, perhaps because how I am in the world is so much part of how I respond to it, the questions that arise around me. And so these modes of paying attention and working with care, I see as perhaps also part of the legacy of feminism. Although we might think a little outside of a patriarchal structure and I think some kinds of ways of working forward. So, thank you. I think that's all I've got to
say. That was so great. I just want to make a comment in terms of just acknowledging the diversity of practice and the depth and the experience across the panel. And I think I definitely want to open up to questions, so any questions people have in there. And just something I mentioned in is it came across in history and in the current practices of your work is this idea of how people work collaboratively, how they connect with other communities. And that sort of, and I think something that comes up for me is this question of the issues of gender representation and equality, but also how that affects your own individual negotiation of putting yourself forward as a practitioner and self-promotion. And I think in a time where there's so much pressure in professional practice and how we promote ourselves and branding and how we see ourselves as a practitioner, how that fits and blends in with this sort of strength of working collectively and connecting with communities of support with our women. And I think, from my experience in the independent and the artist realm, there is a lot of gender equality, a lot of really great peer relationships. I think somehow there's a loss of translation in organisations and institutions and some of those expectations of the market in art. So I'm just wondering how people feel about how they wrestle that balance between putting themselves forward and how they see themselves as an individual woman and as a practitioner. Well, you know, just things around that, whether, you know, often in terms of self-promotion, you know, in terms of maybe people contacting the gallery, we get more men contacting us. And just how that works in terms of an awareness of supporting a powerful funders of saying, women really should put themselves forward, and then I'm like,
I don't want to hear it, but you know what, I'd like to hear it. So I think that tension is a real thing. So I think that's a great thing to have in today's presentation. So yeah, have time to hear that depth of your own practices and quality. I've become recently, someone who kind of gets a little bit, I suppose, which has been the ways that I've moved myself toward art through relationships, and being comfortable in relationships, and having very kind of sincere and honest relationships with curators and peers, and hopefully, you know, moving forward that way. But I move pretty slowly. I like to be kind of to develop that community around myself and to in that way rather than to myself or in that size. So that might actually kind of explain some of the way I've operated as an artist. But it also means that I'm very happy with the way I'm operating in terms of, you know, working with other people, which I see is just so key to an arts practice. It's no way that you can do this stuff by yourself, but it's so much better to do it within a set of strong relationships.
I think you're even more meaningful if you're doing it in groups as well, and that's where you kind of get your strength from. I just noticed while I've been, I felt that, that there's always been more women on the board than men, and at the moment it's all women. And I was just thinking about maybe there's something about women being more encouraged to care for groups or something like that from a young age, and that means that everyone wants to help around them rather than just going, okay, here I go. It's just sort of something that's been built as a natural thing to collect and go on with that. I don't really have an answer to that question other than that that's just an observation.
Yeah.
Maybe the way that things naturally operate. But I think for myself as an artist, I feel like the community is what it's about in some ways. And that there wouldn't be as much pain for me to just like put a notch up and then just, you know,
yeah,
that's how you get big success, I suppose. But in the meantime, it's,
I know this works, but I think it's clear that as when I was a lecturer, it was always clear that people mainly. Our students put themselves forward, male artists, more than women, but it isn't just limited to the arts world, it's everywhere. There's a really funny article, I don't know if I can find it now, maybe find it by Andrew Crabb, you know, Andrew Crabb, the ABC journalist, about women in top positions in law, in the legal profession, still not putting themselves forward the way men do, and that women have to learn to step up, I guess, in a way that men somehow have taken most control but the majority of sort of assumed that role much earlier on. And the article is a very funny article, you know, the gaze women get on their faces when a man's talking to them at a party, presuming they know nothing about the topic, and yet they do. And, you know, it's an entertaining, it's using humour again. But we shouldn't just think it's confined to our industry. You know? It's in all areas.
I'm going to tell them that there's a sustainability that comes out of working with communities and working with young relationships. Mm-hmm. And that's a big thing to be a part of it, and those relationships kind of reveal and develop. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would have that experience if I had approached the industry differently, or as perhaps is being suggested. Mm-hmm. I also am aware that when a woman does act in a very confident manner and get on the phone with young women just out of art school, that it draws your attention and you find yourself saying, oh, pushy.
Yeah.
But, you know, we wouldn't say it quite like that if it was you know, the standards are somewhat different. And I think we all have to take that into account and move from or acknowledge it.
But also, like saying, you need to learn to step up is like, why? We won't have all the other stuff. You know, just stepping up, and, you know, in that way that if you
I mean, I do think women very much make a point. Most women are on boards of artist-run spaces, etc. And you used to find that at art school, it was mostly women, because there's mostly women art students, but were involved in the graduate committees or whatever. And I think we tend to feel more comfortable doing the nurturing. So, and I think that's fine, but I think you have to realise that there's often a problem with falling into those sorts of roles. You know. Or else working with groups and collaborative is another way of working which perhaps overcomes a whole lot of those ideas about having to be a pushy individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's straight. And it's problematic for both of us, but I think it's the great thing with feminism being sort of re-discussed is that there's room for all of this to come up. And I also think something that makes me nervous is I don't feel like I'm a spokesperson for feminism, I'm based on my experience. And I think that's a big shift maybe from previous ideas of being identified and aligned and there's rules about what it means. And I think that's a great just example of that conversation that it's really what works for you, and the idea of attention of how individual artists and how we work collectively, and how, you know, being commercially represented isn't what it used to be, and a lot of models are shifting, or the terms of how the survivors and artists are shifting, and, you know, collective and community practice was big back in the 70s, and in a way, a lot of collective practices may be resurgent because being independent is really, you know, individual artists are quite tough, you know, for other reasons as well. So, yeah, it brings up some interesting issues.